This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
And thank you for coming. Last night I talked a little bit about religion and the presidency over the last half century or so, and indicated that that book had been inspired by the 2000 presidential election campaign. The book I'm talking about today, called Thy Kingdom Come, was actually inspired by the 2004 presidential election campaign. I woke up the day after the election with a hangover, and I hadn't been drinking. And after checking the Canadian Embassy website, I decided I needed to do something about what I thought was this country's ruinous course. And my inspiration, in part, was my son. My older son, during that weekend previous to the campaign, jumped on a bus in New York City and went out to Ohio to knock on doors. And I thought, if he could do that, I could do something. And the next question was, what could I do? Well, knocking on doors is certainly a possibility, and I have done that in the past. But instead, I wrote this book about the religious right and its influence on American politics over the last several decades. I'm going to open by reading the first paragraph of the preface. I write as a jilted lover. The evangelical faith that nurtured me as a child and sustains me as an adult has been hijacked by right-wing zealots who have distorted the gospel of Jesus Christ, defaulted on the noble legacy of 19th century evangelical activism, and failed to appreciate the genius of the First Amendment. They appear not to have read the same New Testament that I open before me every morning at the kitchen counter. When they do quote the Bible, they wrench passages out of context and offer pinched, literalistic interpretations of the Genesis account of creation, for instance, that diminish the scriptures by robbing them of their larger meaning. Essentially, what I argue is that religious right has distorted the words of Jesus, something like find loving and redemptive, and made them into something ugly and punitive. They also, and this comes from the perspective of history, in my judgment, have defaulted on this legacy of 19th century evangelical activism that invariably took the part of those on the margins of society. And try as I will, I simply don't see that range of concerns reflected in the actions and the agenda of the religious right at the turn of the 21st century. In fact, as a historian, I rarely make projections about the future, but I'm persuaded that historians will look back one day on this era of the religious right and its ascendancy in American politics as an aberration in evangelical activism. And I think it's already beginning to happen. Evangelicals are beginning to reclaim the fundamentals of their faith and understand that it will lead them or point them in a very different direction from that that the leaders of the religious right have been pointing them over the last several decades. To try to make that point, I took on several topics, beginning with the issue of sexuality, which of course is always a vexed issue in American life. On March 31st, 2005, there was a remarkable photograph on the front page of the New York Times, directly below the masthead and above the fold, that showed a gathering of religious leaders in Jerusalem, including several Muslim clerics, a representative of Orthodox Christianity, representatives of all the branches of Judaism, a high-ranking delegate from the Roman Catholic Church, all of them gathering there in Jerusalem. And as somebody who studies religion, immediately I got very interested in what could they possibly be talking about? Could they finally be together decrying the violence that has so scarred that part of the world over the last several decades, even centuries? Were they taking a position on the wall that the State of Israel was then constructing to cordon off Palestinians from Jews? What were they talking about? As I read the caption and the accompanying article, it turned out that they were gathered in Jerusalem at the behest of a fundamentalist minister from San Diego, California. a man by the name of Leo Giovannetti. And the purpose of their gathering was not to issue statements on various things that I thought maybe they were talking about, but to issue a statement decrying a proposed gay pride rally in Jerusalem. Well, by that time I was rather interested, so I went out to San Diego to visit Mr. Giovannetti, who is pastor of, it's not a megachurch, but it's a megachurch wannabe, called Mission Valley Community Church in San Diego, California. Leo Giovannetti enjoyed a previous career as a lounge singer in the casinos of Lake Tahoe in Reno, Nevada, but he's now taken on this task of building a megachurch in San Diego, California. I arrived on a Wednesday night, which was Bible study night at Mission Valley, and the text under discussion was one of my favorites, probably my favorite in all of the Bible. The Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 to 7, where Jesus summons his followers to be peacemakers, to turn the other cheek, says that the meek are the ones who will inherit the earth. And somehow, during the course of a 45-minute Bible study, Mr. Giovannetti turned those words of Jesus into a full-fledged rant against abortion and homosexuality. And I still don't know exactly how he did that, but he managed to do that. So I began thinking about that a little bit more. How do we get to that particular point, especially because Jesus himself said nothing about either topic. People have argued that he makes some statements affirming the law of the Hebrew Bible, but if that's the ground for that particular position, then you'd have to be able to adopt a whole other range of behavioral strictures in accordance with those Levitical laws, those Levitical teachings. And it occurs to me that what Jesus did talk about was issues such as poverty and divorce. Pretty clear about that. And as I said last night, my survey of religious right and evangelical attitudes toward divorce indicates that after 1980, with the adoption of Ronald Reagan as their political messiah in 1980, those denunciations of divorce among evangelicals virtually passed from view. Now, there are other factors that are involved in that, not merely the embrace of Ronald Reagan, but the fact that by the late 1970s, tragically, the divorce rate among evangelicals was virtually the same as that in the overall population. So people had to deal with that at a pastoral level, certainly. But it is certainly the case that the denunciations of divorce virtually disappeared after 1980. What happened, I think, is that with the rise of the religious right, there was an attempt on the part of evangelical leaders to locate sin outside of the evangelical community, or at least so they thought. And so you have this embrace of abortion and homosexuality as being the real issues that were issues that needed to be decried by these evangelicals. I attended, in the course of researching this chapter, I attended a meeting in Washington, D.C., actually Arlington, Virginia, across the Potomac, that was a meeting of an organization called the, it's sponsored by this religious right organization called the Institute on Religion and Democracy, which is the Institute of Religion and Democracy, and this was a subgroup that consisted of the heads of the various so-called renewal movements within American mainline Protestantism. So within the, as I'm sure you know, within the Presbyterian Church, within the Methodist Church, within the Episcopal Church and so forth, there are these renewal movements that are trying to bring these denominations to a very conservative position in both theology and politics. And this was a gathering in a Holiday Inn hotel conference room of the various leaders of these so-called renewal movements, and I was there just to observe them and to talk about what they were doing, and they were very kind to me and gracious, at least until they read the chapter, but they were very welcoming. For a day and a half, all I heard was sex, particularly gay sex, and there was a kind of overtone of triumphalism in the rhetoric I was hearing. This will be the issue that will allow us to retake control of these denominations, they said, one after another, as they were issuing their reports about what was going on within these denominations. Finally, toward the end of the gathering, a day and a half into it, I said, do you mind if I ask a question? And I was there as a reporter. I wasn't a participant. But as I said, they were very kind. Sure, he said, sure, go ahead. I said, I'm kind of curious. How many people around this table have a theological objection to the ordination of women? And the group got very silent. And finally, one person, actually an Episcopal woman, said that yes, she had an theological objection or biblical objection to the ordination of women. I said, well, why do you ask? I said, well, I have a pretty good idea that if this group had been meeting 20 years ago or 30 years ago, that you would be sitting around this table voicing your theological and biblical objections to the ordination of women. And they said, they were silent again. They said, well, what are you driving at here? I said, well. And what I was trying to get at, of course, is the historical contingency of biblical interpretation. And I said, well, what bothers me about this conversation is that if I had been alive 60 years ago or 160 years ago, when the issues of the day were respectively segregation and slavery, would I be sitting at this table quoting scripture to justify my opposition to, or my support rather, my support for segregation and for slavery? That very silent. Finally, somebody said, ah, this is different. And I said, okay. How is it different? Tell me how it's different. Another long silence. And somebody said, ah, it's just different. And eventually the moderator moved them on to the next topic. I think that's a telling anecdote about this. The use of the Bible selectively to position them on certain issues that they think are of concern. Another issue that I raise in the book is the issue of the First Amendment, the separation of church and state. The chapter is called Where Have All the Baptists Gone? Probably shouldn't raise that question in Nashville. But anyway, I contend that there are very few Baptists left in America. And for this chapter, I went down to East Texas to visit a man named Rick Scarborough. Some of you probably heard of him. Vision America is his thing. He's not kind of in the top tier of religious right leaders. You did describe him as part of the AAA club waiting to move up to the major leagues. But he certainly aspires to do that. And I went to a rally in Longview, Texas, of 2,000 religious right activists. One of the speakers was Roy Moore, the Alabama Chief Justice, who plopped this 2.5-ton granite monument into the Judicial Building in Montgomery, Alabama. And they were talking about various things, and the statement that was impressed in my memory was a statement on the part of Scarborough himself. I'm a Baptist, he said. And I began to try to interrogate those claims about what it means to be Baptist. The whole idea behind the First Amendment, the separation of church and state, is a Baptist idea. It goes all the way back to the 1630s. Roger Williams, who was a Puritan in Salem, Massachusetts, had come over from the Old World in 1631. Very quickly, he clashed with the Puritan establishment over the issue of church and state, because he recognized that if the state is conflated with the church, ultimately it is the faith, the church, that suffers in that conflation. In his words, he wanted to segregate the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of, again in his words, a wall of separation between the two. For his trouble, of course, Roger Williams was kicked out of Massachusetts, whereupon he went to Rhode Island, which the Puritans regarded as kind of a sinkhole of religious heresy, and founded there a religiously tolerant colony that recognized the rights of minorities and prized the whole idea of diversity, particularly religious diversity. One of founders were crafting the new nation, they drew on Roger Williams and his ideas to writing the Constitution, the First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law concerning respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, Thomas Jefferson had a hand in that, as did James Madison and others. I think it's fair to say that the two sides had different motives. For Jefferson, he didn't want religious factions impinging on the new government. For Williams, his primary concern was not to have the state impinging on the conduct or the operation of the church, the integrity of the church. But my argument is that this has worked remarkably well for more than 200 years. In fact, the Baptists have always been watchmen on the walls of this wall of separation between church and state. Throughout Baptist history, Roger Williams, John Leland, Isaac Bacchus, and in the 20th century, people such as George Washington Truett, who on the steps of the U.S. Capitol in the 1920s delivered this rousing affirmation of Baptist tolerance for religious diversity, religious liberty, as well as the separation of churches. Tragically, however, beginning with the conservative takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1979, Baptists are no longer the watchmen on the wall. There are a few, the Baptist Joint Committee and people like James Dunn and others, who are still concerned about this. But by and large, Baptists have abandoned that role in American society. So we have a situation where the religious right is actually trying to conflate those two entities once again. There's even a movement within the religious right led by people like David Barton and Rick Scarborough, who are trying to deny that the founders ever intended the church and state to be separate. I come to equate these people with the Holocaust deniers and people who debunk global warming, and I try to draw a moral parallel, but simply in the brazenness of their refusal to acknowledge that the founders intended these two entities to be separate. I think there's a real danger in them. There's a danger in all sorts of respects. I think the faith-based initiatives may not technically or legally transgress this boundary between church and state as demarcated by the First Amendment, but I think there's a potential for a lot of mischief there, and there's evidence that this mischief has taken place over the last several years. But again, for the integrity of the faith, it's important to keep those two things separate, lest the faith become fetishized or trivialized. I gave this illustration last night, and I'll repeat myself very quickly. I was one of the expert witnesses in the Alabama Ten Commandments case. And when Judge Thompson ruled correctly that the imposition of this monument in that government space, at the same time, by the way, leaving out all other religious representations. There were other groups, as Roy Moore was planning to put this monument in the courthouse. There were other groups who were calling for representations of their religious views, Hindus and so forth, even the Alabama Atheist Association, both members, I guess, decided that they wanted to have some representation there. And he steadfastly refused any other representation. If he had done that, if he allowed that, I wouldn't have had a problem with it, nobody else would have had a problem with that. But it was only the Ten Commandments, and that's what transgressed this line of separation between church and state. So after Judge Thompson ruled that this violated the First Amendment, the workers were preparing to haul it away. One of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God," apparently forgetting that one of those commandments says something about a graven image. And this is an illustration of the difficulty to the faith when it becomes fetishized in its association with the state. Again, I'll repeat myself from last night. I apologize for doing that. But my position is that religious life has flourished in this country as nowhere else precisely because of the First Amendment. And we Americans who care about the faith, care about religion, Baptists especially because of their historic role, need to be patrolling this line of separation between church and state rather than trying to obliterate it as the religious right is trying to do. Another issue that I think is important is the issue of education. For this chapter, I actually went to Cleveland, Ohio for a couple of reasons. One is that my son was at that during that year in a gap year between high school and college, and he was working for the City Year program in the Cleveland Public Schools. So I wanted to go see Andrew and to see how he was doing and go with him to the schools, but also because, tragically, in my judgment, in 2004, the Supreme Court decided in the Zelman case that the use of taxpayer-paid vouchers for religious schools was constitutionally permissible. I vigorously disagreed with that ruling. I think it's very, very unfortunate. I hope we can reverse it sometime soon. I happen to think that public education is the seedbed for democracy. Public schools, common schools as they were known in the 19th century, were, the whole system was begun, in many cases, by evangelicals. You look through the roster of state commissioners of education in various places, very often they were clergymen, who understood that education provided a kind of bottom rung toward both economic viability as well as Americanness in American society. And common schools provided that common ground, a place where students, at least ideally, and I understand it's an ideal representation, a place where students from different religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and even socioeconomic backgrounds could come together in a classroom, on the playground, explore their differences, celebrate their similarities, and learn how to get together with at least a measure of comity. That strikes me as a recipe for democracy. And throughout most of our history, public education has worked, I think, very, very well. It's not to deny that there are serious problems in public education. I acknowledge that. My sons went to New York City public schools. I recognize that. That's an issue. And money is not the solution to everything. I also recognize that. But I wonder how public schools in this country would look different if we diverted, say, half or a third of the $10 billion a month we're spending to prosecute the war in Iraq toward the school system. I think things would look a whole lot different. What I found in Cleveland, and won't be a surprise to anyone, is that the voucher schools are siphoning the best students away from the public schools, thereby further impoverishing the public schools, both financially as well as in terms of intellectual capacity. This is not a good situation. And if we care about the future of democracy in America, I believe we have to care about public education and public schools. For this chapter, I also went to a place called Patrick Henry College in Western Virginia, about 50 miles from Dulles Airport on the edge of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Patrick Henry College was founded in the year 2000 by a man named Michael Ferris, primarily for evangelical students who had been homeschooled. Ferris was and is kind of a leader of the homeschool movement among evangelicals. And by the way, I think parents have the right to send their children anywhere they want, including to school them at home. I don't have any problem with that. But I don't think that we can afford as a society, as a culture, to innovate or to fail to support our public schools and public education. What Ferris was hearing from a lot of these parents who had homeschooled their kids is, I want a safe place to send my children to college. There's no safe place out there for me. Because of the Liberal Academy and all this stuff. And so Ferris designed Patrick Henry College. Patrick Henry College, if you look at the website, promises not, in effect, not to allow the children of any of these parents to encounter any ideas that their parents would find objectionable, especially, or at least not in any form other than caricature. So the issue of creationism is presented to the students, intelligent design, and so forth. And this school has become fairly successful. It has only about 200 students, at least when I was there was 200 students. I expect it to be even larger now. But this provides an environment for these homeschool kids to get a college education. Won't surprise you to hear that Patrick Henry College is about 95% white, at least. And what worries me, I guess, a little bit about this is here you have students who have their entire lives not had any real serious interaction with anyone outside of their own cohort. And yet, and this is the other dimension of Patrick Kennedy College, they aspire to be national and world leaders. Michael Ferris told the New York Times, the things he hears more frequently than any other from parents is that I want my kid to be on the Supreme Court someday. And Ferris added, well, if we get enough kids in the farm system, that's going to happen. Since 2002, and these figures are dated, I'm sure it's more since then, since 2002, the college has placed 46 of its students as White House interns in Washington, D.C. A larger number have served internships in various offices and agencies in Washington, including the offices of members of Congress who are sympathetic with the religious right. That's fine. They have every right to do that. But I shudder to think that the leadership of this gloriously diverse and pluralistic society for the 21st century will be in the hands of students coming from such a narrow background. I wonder, for example, how many of these students have ever read Catcher in the Rye, the autobiography of Malcolm X, Das Kapital. They've encountered these ideas, but only as caricature. And I fear for our nation if these are the people who are actually going to be running our nation in the 21st century. Another issue is the issue of creationism, intelligent design. By the way, I stand before you here today offering surefire proof of the existence of evolution. Because if you take the first couple of chapters of Genesis, which by the way purport to be neither history nor science, and you want to teach them in the public school classroom, you call it creationism, that's your first step. The courts step in and say, no, this is religion, it's not science, it doesn't belong in the science classroom. And so creationism evolved into something called scientific creationism. And once again, the courts step in, and by the way, the judicial record on this is very extensive. The court stepped in and said, no, this is religion, it's not science, it doesn't belong in the science classroom. And so it evolved yet again into something called intelligent design, which posits that there is a possibility that there may be some sort of unnamed intelligent force behind the creation of the universe. And once again, in the Dover, Pennsylvania case, as you know, I'm sure, Judge Jones, who, by the way, was appointed to the federal bench by George W. Bush, issued a stinging rebuke to intelligent design after listening to weeks and weeks of testimony on this particular issue. Now I'm sure they're working on the next evolutionary form of creationism, and I'm not sure what's going to be called, but keep checking for an update on that one. As a person of faith, I happen to believe in something pretty much close to intelligent design. Although I guess I've fallen into the habit over the last half century of calling the intelligent designer God, but what do I know? But it's not science. And I think the attempt on the part of the religious right to baptize science as religion, to baptize religion as science, ultimately denigrates the faith. I made a decision a long time ago that I would not allow the canons of Enlightenment rationalism be the final arbiter of truth. I elect to live in an enchanted universe where there are forces at play that I can't begin to understand, much less explain. I wouldn't live anywhere else. And to take the faith and try to retool it according to the canons of science ultimately does a disservice to the faith. And by the way, I don't think that the opposite of faith is doubt. I happen to think that doubt is an essential component of faith. And if I have all these questions answered, what need have I for faith? So again, I think the intelligent design people are doing us a disservice, doing the faith a disservice. What's really behind it I think it's a larger agenda. And for this chapter, I went to Princeton University for a debate between Lee Silver, who's a molecular biologist at Princeton, and William Dembski, who's kind of the high priest of the intelligent design movement. It was a fascinating debate, as you might imagine. I think Lee Silver got the better of William Dembski, who was being very evasive about what exactly he meant and what this intelligent design force was and so forth. But I think the real victory can be attributed to Dembski, because he was able, in the university context, to get that debate there in the first place, with a lot of corporate sponsorship, by the way. I think the real agenda here is to undermine the academy and what is perceived by the religious right as the liberal bias of the academy. Now, I'm prepared to talk about that and argue that maybe there is a liberal bias, and thank God there is. The academy may be the last institution in our culture that has not been taken over by conservatives, and we need to have at least that defense, it seems to me. But in a very important way, however, the academy is inherently conservative in that issues of hiring and review and tenure have to go through this long and very complex and drawn-out process to see if new ideas pass intellectual muster and are credible. And within each discipline, there are different criteria applied to make that determination. So, for example, when I, as a historian, came up for tenure, the committee, one of several committees, and there are several reviews along the way, made a decision based on a review of everything that I had written, which in turn was reviewed by peers before its publication in academic journals or by university presses to make sure that I had followed the canons of historical scholarship, that I was a responsible scholar before I was allowed to proceed through the process of filing to win tenure many, many years ago. That is a very conservative process. It means that people who are coming in from the side rarely meet. In the case of people who advocate for intelligent design, there is, as near as I can tell, only one tenured professor in the country. This may be a bit of an exaggeration, but one notable tenured professor in the country who advocates intelligent design. They have been Michael Behe at Lehigh University. And the issue is not a bias against intelligent design. It is that those who have advocated and written about intelligent design have not been able to publish their findings in peer-reviewed journals because they haven't met the canons of scientific inquiry, the standards of scientific inquiry. The scientific method, as I understand it, I'm not a scientist by any stretch of imagination, is that all ideas have to be vindicated by the scientific method, which includes the standard of falsifiability. And as George Will, conservative columnist, indicated about intelligent design, the problem is not that it's false, the idea that there's an intelligent creator behind the formation of the world. The problem is that it's not falsifiable. And therefore, it does not meet the canons of scientific inquiry. And therefore, it is not, so far, part of the academy. But that is their goal. They want to diminish what they consider to be the liberal bias of the university, of the academy. My contention is that the academy is, in fact, inherently conservative in that ideas have to be vetted again and again and again before they win any sort of credibility. The final issue that I will talk about is the environment. You would think that the people who want to teach intelligent design in the public schools would evince some interest in the handiwork of the intelligent designer. So far, that is not entirely evident. For this chapter, I went up to a place called the Assabla Institute, which is in the northern part of the lower peninsula of Michigan, hard by Grand Traverse Bay, for an evangelical study group called the Assabla Institute, that draws students from Christian colleges from around the country, places like Messiah College, Wheaton College, Calvin College, Gordon College, Westmont College, and so forth, for several weeks or an entire summer of scientific inquiry. They teach courses in science, a stream ecology or whatever it might be, but they also teach courses in environmental ethics, in which they argue, by the way, for something, a principle called moral considerability, which I hadn't encountered. Moral considerability, quickly, is the notion that all of the created order needs to be considered in moral terms, not merely humanity, but all created order, as something that comes from God and needs our protection, needs our stewardship. Students come back from this program, I'm persuaded, with a new understanding of the natural world, of the role of the Creator in the natural world, and also our responsibility as individuals and as evangelicals for the care of the created order. And more I'm persuaded that this is the new wave among evangelicals. I mentioned a bit about this last night. I predicted in Thy Kingdom Come that this would be the wedge issue that would finally loosen the grasp of the leaders of the religious right on the evangelical community, the issue of the environment and climate change and global warming and things of this sort. And more I'm seeing this. A younger generation of evangelicals sees that we have a responsibility toward the natural world, and we cannot simply disregard it. The old guard, however, is very, very much in evidence. In the fall, in October 2005, there was a gathering of religious right leaders in Cornwall, Connecticut, actually not far from where I live, up in northwestern Connecticut, for the ostensible purpose of writing a statement about environmental concern and environmental stewardship. It's called the Cornwall Declaration, and it's on the web. I invite you to look at it and read it for yourself. It starts with these sort of pious affirmations about how people of faith need to be concerned about the created order. But if you read carefully through that document, it's a very cynical document. It says, in effect, that we should allow market forces to determine what parts of the environment need to be preserved and what can be exploited for corporate gain. Market forces. We're seeing on Wall Street what market forces are doing right now. So I'll leave that comment aside. It is a profoundly cynical statement signed by people like Chuck Colson, James Dobson, Michael Cromarty, Donald Wildman, the usual suspects in this respect. That is the old way of thinking, and I think there's evidence that evangelicals are moving to a new position on the environment, and I hold out hope that this will provide for a recasting, a reorientation of evangelical political activism and social thought in the years to come. Let me conclude, and perhaps we'll have time for questions, with a few paragraphs from the conclusion, if I may. Evangelicals need once again to learn to be a counterculture, much as they were before 1980, before they succumb to the seductions of power. Evangelicals must stand against what St. Paul called the principalities and powers of this world. The early followers of Jesus were a counterculture because they stood apart from the prevailing order. Counterculture can provide a critique of the powerful because it is utterly disinterested. It has no investment in the power structure itself. Indeed, the most effective and vigorous religious movements in American history have identified with the downtrodden and have positioned themselves on the fringes of society rather than in the centers of power. The Methodists of the 19th century come to mind, as do the Mormons. In the 20th century, Pentecostalism, which initially appealed to the lower classes and made room for women and people of color, became perhaps the most significant religious movement of the century. A counterculture identifies with those on the margins. Jesus felt more comfortable with lepers and prostitutes and tax collectors than he did with the rulers of society. That is the posture of a counterculture, and it is a posture more becoming to those who number themselves among the followers of Jesus than hankering after worldly influence. Since beginning my travels, I've developed an even greater suspicion of the bloviating preachers of the religious right, Those who have anointed themselves shepherds of the flock and the arbiters of morality. They have led their sheep astray from the gospel of Jesus Christ to the false gospel of neoconservative ideology and into the law of the Republican Party. And yet my regard for the flock and my respect for the integrity of rank and file evangelicals is undiminished. Ultimately, it is they who must recover the scandal of the gospel and rescue us from the depredations of the religious right. I challenge my fellow believers to reclaim their birthright as evangelical Christians and examine the scriptures for themselves, absent the funhouse mirror distortions of the religious right. For those equal to the task, I suggest a form of shock therapy. Juxtapose the Sermon on the Mount, arguably the highest expression of Christian ethics, with the platform of the Republican Party. Would Jesus, who summoned his followers to be peacemakers and invited them to love their enemies, jump at the opportunity to deploy military forces, especially at the cost of so many civilian lives? How do we reconcile reckless consumerism and tax cuts for the affluent with Jesus' warnings against storing up treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal? Is the denial of equal rights to anyone, women or Muslims or immigrants or gays, consistent with the example of the man who healed lepers and paralytics and who spent much of his time with the cultural outcasts of his day? I suspect that when Jesus asked us to love our enemies, he probably didn't mean that we should torture or kill them. I doubt that the man who expressed concern for the tiniest sparrow would approve the systematic despoiling of the environment in the interest of corporate profits. Jesus calls his followers to a higher standard. The Bible I read tells of freedom for captives and deliverance from oppression. It teaches that those who refuse to act with justice or who neglect the plight of those less fortunate have some explaining to do. But the Bible is also about good news. It promises redemption and forgiveness, a chance to start anew, and with divine help to get it right. My evangelical theology assures me that no one, not even Karl Rove or James Dobson, lies beyond the reach of redemption, and that even a people led astray can find their way home. That sounds like good news to me. Very good news indeed.